She snatched at my arm with her hands, and I drove my right fist into her face. I didn't pull the punch either. If her darker nature was allowed to continue, it would destroy her, killing me as a byproduct of the process. Her head snapped back against the ground, and she blinked her eyes, stunned. I stood up, took a few steps back, and stuffed my injured hand into my pocket. I was tired and feeling shocky. My whole arm felt cold. I didn't stop falling back until I was sure I could shield in time to hold her off if she came at me. I recognized it when Susan checked back in. Her breathing slowed, becoming controlled and steady. It took her 4 or 5 minutes of focus to push her darker self out of control, but eventually she did. She sat up slowly. She licked at her blood-stained lips and shuddered in slow ecstasy for a second before dashing her sleeve across her mouth and forcing herself to her feet. She looked around wildly, a terrible dread in her eyes, until she spotted me. She stared at me for a moment and then closed her eyes. She whispered, "Thank God." I nodded to her and beckoned for her to stand at my side. I waited until she reached me. Then we both turned to face the Earl King. Off to one side, the members of the Red Court remained where they had been, save that this time Esteban and Esmeralda had been trapped in the goblins' nets as well. I had apparently been too intent on Susan to hear the sound of any struggle in the aftermath of the duel, but I could guess what had happened. As soon as the ick had begun to falter, they must have made a run for it. This time, though, they hadn't had the advantage of showing up in a totally unexpected place, with the goblins intent upon their meals. This time, the goblins had taken them, probably before they had actually begun to flee. Both of the Ebes were staring at Susan and me with raw hatred written on their snarling faces. The Earl King looked at the captured vampires for a moment and smiled faintly. "Well fought," he said, his deep voice resonant. We both bowed our heads slightly to him. Then he lifted his hand and snapped his fingers once. It echoed like the report of a firearm. Screams went up from the helpless Red Court crew as several hundred violence-amped goblins fell on them in a wave. I watched for a moment in sickened fascination, but turned away. I hate the Red Court, but there are limits. The Earl King's kin had none. "What about the Red King?" I asked him. "The Lords of Outer Night?" His red eyes gleamed.
"His Majesty's folk failed to prove their peaceful intentions. The trial established their deception to the satisfaction of law and custom. Let him howl his fury if he so wills it. Should he begin a war over this matter, all of Faerie will turn upon him in outrage, and his people will make fine hunting."
Beneath the screams of the Red Court, Esmeralda's were especially piercing, a ragged chuckle ran through the hall. The sound danced with its own echoes. It was like listening to the official soundtrack of hell. A goblin wearing thick leather gloves appeared, holding what was left of Susan's club as if it were red hot. The touch of iron and its alloys is an agony to the creatures of Faerie. Susan accepted the steel calmly, nodding to the gloved goblin. "I presume then," I said quietly, "that we are free to go."
"If I did not release you now," the Earl King said, his tone almost genial, "how should I ever have the pleasure of hunting you myself some fine, bright evening?" I hoped my gulp wasn't audible.
The Lord of the Hunt turned and gestured idly with one hand, and a way shimmered into being behind us. The green light that had let us see began to darken rapidly.
"May you enjoy good hunting of your own, Sir Knight, Lady Huntress. Please convey my greetings to the Winter Queen."
My sane brain fell asleep at the switch, and I said, "I will. It was a pleasure, Earl."
Maybe he didn't get it. He just tilted his head slightly, the way a dog does at a new sound.
We all bowed to one another politely, and Susan and I stepped through the way, careful not to take our eyes off of our host, until the world shimmered and that hall of horrors was gone. It was replaced with an enormous rustic-style building that appeared to be filled from the basement to the ceiling with everything you might possibly need to shoot, catch, find, stalk, hook, clean, skin, cook, and eat pretty much anything that ran, slithered, hopped, or swam.
What the hell? Susan said, looking around in confusion.
Huh, I said. This is the Bass Pro in Bolingbrook, I think. Makes sense, I guess.
I didn't mean that, she said and pointed. Look.
I followed her gaze to a large clock on the far wall of the big store. It said that the time was currently 9:30 p.m., 30 minutes after our departure time.
How can that be? Susan demanded.
We were there for half an hour at the most. Look, my watch says it's 2. My heart began to beat faster.
Hell's bells, I didn't even think of it.
Of what? I started walking. Susan ditched her club behind a shelf and followed me. We must have made a charming sight, both of us all scuffed up, torn, ragged, and wounded. A few late shoppers stared, but no one seemed willing to approach us. Time can pass at a different rate in the Never Never than it does here, I said. All those stories about people partying with the Fae overnight and waking up in a new century, that's why it happens. The next link in the logic chain got forged, and I said, oh. Oh, damn it.
What? Susan said. It's a 3-hour trip to Chichen Itza, I said quietly. We can't get there by midnight.
Lead ingots began to pile up in my belly and on my shoulders and the back of my neck. I bowed my head, my mouth twisting bitterly.
We're too late.